Okay, it was a good break, wasn't it? One of the favorite parts. And you know, somebody once said, you can tell sort of the generosity or the flavor of the church by how their buffets are. And I think you can tell something of the quality of this group, you know, that they feed the body as well as the mind. And that this place, I've known about this for a long time, not as long as some of you who go back, what is it, 30 years it goes back? 31 years. I've been in Santa Barbara all that time, but I have known about it, and because Thursday is one of my most important therapy days, days to see patients, I kept on not coming, you know. And then last September, I felt I really needed to come, and I have not been disappointed. I have felt so nurtured by you know, the overall ambience of what happens here. And so I express a lot of gratitude and can say, much in the spirit of what we were talking about is nard and oil, that this group is like a nard for my soul. And I know it is for others, because we've exchanged those ideas in our conversations with one another. Well, I want to finish up with a few thoughts and then open it up to thoughts from the group. sort of like the basic idea that in a way Mark has presented for us in his juxtaposition of frame and object frame is all or nothing, in the idea of Judas is known, he's stuck, he's arrested in his hanging himself and handing over Jesus. And the unnamed woman, sort of arrested in the notion of all, she gave her all. As we live our life, we have to in some way try not to always want to stamp becoming with being. Because being in some way is an arrest. You know, and our heartbeat, if we like diastolic better than systolic or vice versa, would be dead. Okay? So the work is to hold the tension of the both hand. And that's not easy. When most both ands, unlike diastolic and systolic, most both ands, we could say one is good and one's not so good or bad. You know, one of the developments of psychological thought in an infant, David Winnicott, talks about this kind of dialectic between illusion, the excitement for the mother, and disappointment, as being learning how to love and hate. And he always talks about how important it is for an infant, to be able to hate without having the experience of the outer mother being destroyed by it. You know, that the mother can contain those powerful opposites. So I had an incident in my office just a couple of days ago of somebody who had the experience of a grandbaby, having a huggy blanket. And Winnicott's the one who developed a lot about the huggy blanket. He called it the transitional object. And it's like the object in which the infant can, so to speak, temporarily destroy the mother, you know? And how important it is not to wash that huggy blanket too often. Because you sort of wash away all the work the child's done with it. You know? That's to start all over again, you know, showing traces of their the enormous negative energy that you feel when the mother disappoints, or the father, but that the parental figure is away too long. to just follow this up with one more little gem, I think, from the psychological work that's being done now on infants. The statement is this, that if, this is Melanie Klein, if the infant was totally satisfied by the mother, totally gratified, the mother has no needs of her own, she's always there, that the infant would not have a mind. Literally. That a mind is developed in the absence of the parent. Woo! Isn't that a way of reimagining our anxiety? That when we have anxieties, and that goes for all of our anxieties of absence, and nearly all of our greatest anxieties can be reduced to separation, you know, absence. Mm-hmm. That is the time we make a mind. And those of you who have followed some of the spiritual masters, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, you know, it's not in the consolation of God that one grows spiritually, but in the desolation. Mm-hmm. You know, the experience of being able to hold on to an experience of God when one does not even feel God is absent, but one feels God is not gone. That's when one develops spiritually. So this idea of when we can have both and in rather close proximity of one another, that's the place in which we get practice, like practice riding a bicycle, or practice, I don't mean that literally, but practice doing something over and over again, being in illusion, being in disillusion, being in illusion, being in disillusion. I'm pretty excited about Obama as a leader, but will he disappoint?
Yeah.
You betcha. And we've gone through a mini, I'm trying to wait. And the both and, it's so interesting, it's been done just this one week. I don't know if you listen to the news, but Obama's the hero again, you know, in the media, you know, because he was like, he went through almost total deconstruction in the last 4 days. And because he has a quality, which is a word I'd like us to hold on to, he has a quality that I've seen in very few people at the level he has. In a matter of 4 days, it's sort of come around to a place again of, this is the one. The quality is resilience. Mm-hmm. Resilience, I think, is what we would like to strive for. Now, resilience is what people tell us we should look for in our hearts on a physiological level. That's why they suggest that our heart is going to last longer if we exercise it. Mm-hmm. You know? Why? Because we make the heart more pliant by making it do more work. Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I think on the level of faith, this is true also. Exposing ourselves sometimes to threatening statements or reflecting on whatever challenges us is important. And a group like this is a wonderful one to do it in, because a container helps. Because there's always the possibility of being Judas, in some way getting caught at the outside. And, you know, as I said, because I don't want to over-idealize this woman, that caught in two maybe naive and unexamined, say, acceptance of Jesus, or of our husbands, you know, or of our parents, or of our leaders, that we're always willing in some way to be disillusioned and to have to sort of begin again the search. There's a word that I learned some years ago, but I was pleased to find it in Borg's book that we read last semester. Mm-hmm. It's sclerocardia. Mm-hmm. What does that translate to?
Heart attack.
Yeah. Hardness of heart. Jesus warns us against hardness of heart. Well, resilience of the heart, literally, through exercise, through, you know, heart-healthy foods and all that, can be a model for avoiding sclerocardia, hardness of heart, psychologically and, I think, spiritually. I know that sometimes people who come my way come because they have a broken heart. Either the person they love has left, has been betrayed, or the ultimate betrayal, they've died, and there is a kind of resolution not to love again. You know? And this is what I think we need to ward against, hardness of heart. When I last presented here, I did a lot of material from one of my favorite pals in the book world, Pema Chodron. Mm-hmm. I think she works the Buddhist story in a way that's incredibly readable by us. Some of you might know she was a Catholic. She was the mother of a bunch of kids, and she converted to Buddhism, and she is the prioress of a Buddhist abbey in Canada. And she really works the material in a way that's linguistically close to our experience, so that when she says something, it doesn't sound like it's come from India. You know, we can recognize our lives in it. Well, Alice Walker says of Pema Chodron, she says, from her and her work, I've been learning the most pressing and necessary lesson of all, how to keep opening wider my heart. You know, that's like the resilience. How do I do that? How do I keep my heart from growing hard? How do I keep it soft? And I assure you, there's no way of doing it without going through periods of disillusionment. You know? I'd like to wrap this up. So, as with Obama, so with Jesus, maybe prior with Jesus, we will be disappointed. And there are a myriad of ways we could be disappointed. One touches close to what Christine said might be true of Jesus, of Judas, and that is that we might be disappointed because not so much because Jesus failed in the sense of saying, he wasn't who we thought he'd be, but because he'd be too much. Mm-hmm. You know, that we might identify with the rich young man who asked Jesus, what do I have to do to deserve, you know, to get eternal life? And he says, do the commandments, blah, blah, blah. Well, I've done that all my life, sir. Well, what else? Well, Saul can follow me, you know? Now, that won't be literally in our lives, but, you know, that's a moment. And I hadn't thought of that. You had brought that point. Maybe Judas had that moment, you know, where it was too much, you know? But I was reading Chet Myers' book to get any added thoughts around this, and he was commenting on the notion of failed discipleship. And it was at that sort of point that I realized moments that I've come to in my life. You know, you're not going to ask this of me, are you? You know, I don't want to go that way. And I think, you know, I can say that was a moment I had, Ginny, when I, you know, Ginny goes through these moments of selling all. And I think what I at least did much the same way as I did around the peace movement when my husband let himself get arrested and I didn't dare because I had a license, several licenses to protect, you know. I had to decide of where my sell all was and that it might not be as radical as someone else's. So some of the point is that there's a lot of place in which we sell all, but it might not look the way that somebody else's sell all is going to look. And we've got to be honest, because we've got to be able to contain it. Otherwise, there is always the example of Judas, you know, the person who strives too much to be perfect. What is it? The perfect is the enemy of the good? Is that how that statement goes? I'm not sure. So, maybe it's the enemy of the possible. The perfect is the enemy. I think that's right. Okay, so I'll have time for questions. The wrap-up is this quotation. We always want to stamp becoming with being. Is there anybody who knows to whom that thought is attributed? He's the guy we like to make fun of. Nietzsche. Nietzsche. The church was perplexic around Nietzsche, you know? And that's one reason is I read that little piece by Richard Rohr on the emergent church, and he says in there that that the Roman church certainly has had an obsession with verbal orthodoxy. You know, that is a real wanting to stamp becoming with being. And you can imagine the church toward the end of the 20th, the, what century I have trouble with, the 19th century, when Nietzsche was right, you know, they really found him threatening, because Nietzsche was basically saying something, there is no certainty. And we want to say, oh yeah, the church is certain, you know, the church is, you know, we can stamp becoming with being. And perhaps the thing that we get from the emergent church is that they let us know that it's okay to be enlightened about the enlightenment. That the enlightenment, which was the time of the age of reason, the age of rationalism, and it's such, so incongruent, you know, that the church is, because we can throw a very wide net here, including other religions besides Christianity, where there is such a room for ambivalence that they wanted us to remove doubt. That was sort of like the cost of membership is not to doubt, to have no doubt. You could say, as Larson says in that same little piece by Richard Rohr, that what the emergent church is doing for us, it's telling us it's okay to be doubtful about human certainty. So let's see what we can say about Nietzsche. I know Keith knows this one, you know, one of the things Nietzsche is particularly famous for is the statement, God is dead. Mm-hmm. Well, someone had a t-shirt and it said, Nietzsche is dead, my God. But I want to say is we can't rest in that, Nietzsche's dead, sign God. What we need is both and.
Yeah.
God is dead because in some way we have to reimagine God all the time, because we're always on the journey and always experiencing Godness in new ways, and we have new language as we move along. And, you know, always what we say, the Nietzsche in us, is going to die. And so we sort of need to have these two in dialogue, the illusion and the disillusion, whichever of those pair we're sort of struggling with. And not to say around this particular example, statement Nietzsche is dead, son God, not to stay with that as a gotcha. Okay? But also not to avoid saying it. You know, not to afraid to be a smart ass. You know, but then know that you can't end being a smart ass. You have to then sort of allow that to be, so to speak, deconstructed or played with or held together. Nietzsche really encountered a pretty dead God in the 19th century. And we would most likely not recognize that concept of God today, especially this group. And so Nietzsche did us a favor by saying that and penetrating us so that we had to think about it. And thus we move on. Okay, with that, let me just, there's more things that could be said, but let's hear from people in there, which thoughts you have, Jenny.
Well, one of the things when you talked about doubt is what came to me was the movie of what a good job they did of showing that how certainly finally at the end she has doubt, which I thought
was a conversion experience.
It was.
Yes. So wonderful. Yes. And Mary.
It's probably a topic for another day, but I'm just intrigued. When you ended up talking about we must be willing to be disillusioned, because it helps us avoid hardness of heart, and what we want to do is open our hearts.
Yeah.
I look back to that riff that you did on who is my mother and who is my father.
Uh-huh.
And I thought about kind of the commandment was honor your father and mother.
Uh-huh.
And then when Jesus said, well, who is my mother and father? You are. And I think it's part of that deconstructing and breaking down
the literalism
and the littleness of only caring about your family.
Yes.
And not seeing that your family is, you know, much broader than that.
Yeah. Very nice.
In conjunction with that, I was thinking too that what Jesus, the gospel, what it is saying through the ages and what he did, he was saying the kingdom of God is bigger than all the rules. And you've got all the family rules going, and you know, the left of the dead, buried, buried, dead. You know, he takes all of those boxes and replaces them with love and compassion, and those are the things of the kingdom, lavishly. And he just, we can't believe it. And here's this woman who is symbolizing this kind of thinking. I mean, she's not outside the box. She captured the idea of the kingdom, that actually we can give our things away. We can lavishly love like God loves. I mean, think that's such an amazing microcosm of what he's saying to us. And the whole idea of family, too, because they lived in a culture of all the family rules and everything, the heirs and all that.
Yes.
And he's just going, no, it's about us.
Yes. And that idea of extravagance, so really open, needs the antidote of being at times. Mm-hmm. You know, both are necessary. Mm-hmm. When I taught my students, this was a statement I used a lot, and I said to them, knowing that many of them, their typology, Jungian typology, nearly always involves F and P. And a P person writes their term papers when the date's due. You know, that's when they begin. They have a sort of a hard time planning ahead. And I would say, but the one exception to this is your term paper. Then I want you to stamp becoming with being. And know that I will know that it's a work in progress. You know? But that you must be willing to formulate. You must be willing to put something in some form. And we can have an aversion against it, some typologies more so than others, because you know, if you're really on the poor end naturally of the becoming, you never want to say or have something attributed to you. You always want something to be sort of like in progress or in movement. But we need both poles.
Yeah.
I don't know your name. I'm sorry.
Anna. My name is Anna. Or maybe you can describe the distinction between the psychological and the spiritual in the all or nothing concept. For the psychological, it's a painful thought that it's all or nothing because we're humans and we can't function in the all. But isn't the goal or the model spiritually to be the all? The awe-inspired?
I think it's more dangerous than helpful.
Spiritually?
Yep. If you see the Buddha on the road,
kill him.
Because on the journey we do not arrive. And if we think we arrive, then that's what's dangerous. You know? And I think that even our images of God, this is why, you know, the Jewish people didn't have icons or images, because they're sort of like that intuition. That is dangerous. You know, actually, it's the other side. Not to have images is dangerous also, because images foster the imagination, and the imagination is, you know, the antidote. But I think any articulation of godness is only an approximation. And if we want to take that and say that's God, then that's where we move into all those kinds of things that Jesus railed against, like self-righteousness, you know, of the scribes and Pharisees, the holder of the images of God back then. So, you know, you might experience it differently, but that's what I see that in spirituality. And I think if you read the mystics, you will see that they always were suspicious of arriving, of having the experience of arriving. Yeah.
I see a very interesting parallel here, it's not a thing you said, between particle physics and astrophysics. In particular, quantum theory and Heisenberg, Planck, the uncertainty principles and things that are sort of impossible to understand. And I was thinking about resilience, and the opposite of resilience being certainty. You know, I have the truth. I have the only truth. And I think one of the things I'm getting is that doubt is so very important, but it's not everything. But it's like speaking about Obama and other people, to be able to cling to the ideas of love, a God, however you want to imagine him, that this is the, or not, you know, the unimaginable, if you will.
Yeah.
There's a you have to have a certain amount of humility, but a great deal of strength and courage
mm-hmm.
at the same time. And that.
Mm-hmm. That's very nice. And that whole idea of how in, you know, in the quantum physics or how they play with the idea of the infinite. And to go back to your question, again, Anna's question of all, I would say, if you also accept God as nothing, not, which is, you know, Eckhart, God is nada, 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 nothing. And God is all, if also God is nothing, then one can say that holding allows for a kind of deconstruction. But when we want to make God all, and we are basically materialist at some experiential level, it's very hard to do that without idolatry.
And that's why the Jews don't say the name of God, or write, you know, because
or have the icons.
As soon as you name it, you've already lost it.
Yes.
So, I mean, you don't have it. So
yes.
If we can only, the best we can do is approximate.
Yes.
But
yes.
I'm just backing up what you've already said.
Yes, yes. Well, the idea that there is some advantage to approximating, you know, because it allows us to get to a step that can be a tentative place, like the desert. You know, you might have to wander in it for 40 years, and then you can go through the walls of Jericho and the Red Sea and all those other things and go and, you know. But if we look at the history, salvation history, boy, those Jews had a hard time. You know, they no sooner got into the land of Galilee, the land flowing with milk and honey, that they go off into two different exiles, you know, and they're away and they come back. And it's all construction and deconstruction, construction and deconstruction. And then the last 2,000 years they've spent in the diaspora, you know. And so it's the story there is the story of diastolic and systolic. Yeah.
Yeah, there's many theories that actually the universe is based on destruction.
Yeah.
And you cannot have construction without destruction.
Yeah.
And the same with any of the Eastern traditions, the whole thing is the nothing. It's no thing in order to have something.
Yeah.
It's just
I have a patient that if she listens to this on Kate Kyle, you know who you are, who just recently said to me, she practices Buddhism, and she was at a Zendo, and then she had a discussion afterwards with the masters, and she said, oh, you know, I just wish I could be I could be compassionate enough being to be compassionate of all my faults, you know? And he says, compassion, shamashin. you can make that an idol.
Exactly. Spiritual materialism.
Yes. Yes. I have to bring it to a close. I got the word. Thank you so much.
Yes, let it rouse the crowd.